It's a brand new best podcast in baseball. I'm joined during rain delay theater by the great Mark Tompkin. We're going to talk about what Cardinals fans can expect from a front office run by Chaim Bloom, who was here in Tampa Bay for a long time. But also, we'll get into a whole lot more, including, well, we're at a minor league ballpark, and I don't know anyone else who has been to both minor league ballparks who's willing to go on the podcast. So I'm going to talk to Mark about that. Here we go. Cue the music. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closet by Design of St. Louis. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, joined this week by the great and what perpetually writing, constantly reporting Mark Tompkin of the Tampa Bay Times. Mark, you've been doing this a long time. Ever had a year where, like this one at this ballpark, covering the Rays?
No, I think this is going to be... I mean, recency bias aside, one of the years when I get done, I've done all 28 seasons, and obviously the World Series run in 2008, obviously the first year, 2020, those are all years that stand out for specific reasons. But I think the combination of everything this year, what caused the Rays to have to move out of Tropicana Field, and all the impact and trickle down that's effect that's had, and then as well as what's happened on the field, has been kind of a weird year too. Is that they were not good. They were the best team in baseball for 6 weeks. They've been the worst team in baseball for about 12 weeks since, and I think they've had 8 guys make their major league debut. So it's just been a really weird year all the way around. So it's certainly an honor to get to be on the best podcast in baseball to be able to discuss this.
What is it? I mean, you live here. Let's not overlook that. So you know, the hurricane came through and it complicated and challenged your life, not just your professional, but your personal. What has the recovery been like since the hurricane went through? We see the damage done to Tropicana, obviously, and we can look at the picture in the visitors clubhouse where the roof is just in tatters. They put up one of the panels. They have so much more to go. But just in general, what's the recovery been like here?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. There's still we could have, had we not had so many other fun things to do during your stay here, but we could have gone for a drive out by the beach area where I live, and there's still people that haven't recovered, and we're coming up on the one-year anniversary, right? It was early September when two hurricanes in a row. It was really Helene and Milton. They were within 2 weeks apart, and we're coming up on the anniversary of those, and the damage that they caused in this community was extensive. I mean, there's a list of, you know, just from a selfish standpoint, a list of favorite places, my favorite pizza place, one of our favorite beach bars. These places just have not, and apparently are not going to reopen. They just were damaged enough. Their business model was damaged enough, physically damaged enough, that they're not reopening. So it's changed this community, and there's still many, many signs of that. From a personal standpoint, it was kind of weird. It was like the triple crown of things here. My wife's a school teacher. So there's one school in Pinellas County out of the hundreds of schools that had enough damage from the hurricane that they couldn't reopen. They had to relocate for an entire year. That was her school. Mm. I do most of my professional work at Tropicana Field when the team's in town. Hit by the hurricane, couldn't reopen. The Tampa Bay Times office building, which was... Yeah. It was three different buildings, but it started at the first building was there over 100 years ago. A construction crane working on a condo across the street during the hurricane gets loose, slashes the building. The building can't be repaired. So we lost the Times office building, the Tropicana Field Stadium where I did most of my work, and my wife's school. So we were fortunate our home was fine, but we were certainly impacted in other ways.
I'm glad to hear that about your home. But gosh, I mean, it just speaks to how much things just get uprooted just when with highway. I mean, I lived in New Orleans for a while and I saw that there. I lost a car, but didn't lose any of my home. But other friends were, and people were not as fortunate. The hope for the Rays is that they're back at Tropicana next year and they're not in this temporary. I'm real curious to know. I see this going three ways, and I always kind of get the sense, whether it's because of your questions to the commissioner every All-Star break or just in reading your coverage or hearing people talk, it always seems like the Rays are like balancing on a precipice. Like they're either being nudged into having strong roots here and staying here and getting what they want with the stadium, or they're on their way out of town. I'm like, this is not going to work. And I get the sense that there's three ways this could have gone. The hurricane could have pushed them in one of those directions, or it could have just left them teetering still. Where are they now? Are they still teetering in this limbo of, you know, not having strong roots here but not having a path out?
Kind of, sort of, yeah. I mean, all the above. It's funny what you say, because I think about that when you were saying that, is I went from covering the expansion beat. I started on baseball in 87. I'd been at the Times just a couple of years at that point, and we didn't really have a baseball writer. So got going and started going to owners' meetings, started going to World Series. There'd be a press conference. People would ask real questions, and I'd be the guy in the back saying, what about expansion? Is Tampa Bay among the expansion options? So I was that guy for a while. Then the Marlins and Rockies were awarded, and Tampa Bay missed out. Then it was like, oh, what does that mean? Then MLB decided to expand again pretty quickly. That was unexpected, Maybe forced by some legal threats. They expand again. Tampa Bay gets a team. It's like, oh, cool. So then it was a couple years of, okay, what do you think of the way Tampa Bay is building their organization? Then they get started. Then they're terrible. Then they win the World Series, or get to the World Series, or they win the AL pennant, get to the World Series in 08. It's like, okay, this is kind of cool. And then here we are again with, I'm the one asking the questions. What about the future of the Rays? What about the stadium situation? What about the ownership situation? So there's a lot of uncertainty. As we sit here and record the best podcast in baseball, the team is, there's kind of a handshake agreement in principle to sell the team to a new group. We're told that deal's probably going to close sometime in mid-September. Transfer power will happen at the end of the season. So the ownership picture is in flux. We think we know where it's going to go, but we don't know much. We only have a couple names from the new ownership group. We don't know who most of the partners are. We don't know how much money they have. We don't know what they're going to do. Are they going to raise the payroll, lower the payroll? We're told they're not going to clean house. We think they're going to keep most of the core, but there's a lot of uncertainty that goes with that. Current stadium, short-term stadium, Tropicana Field, as you say, the city of St. Petersburg is obligated to repair it. That's part of the lease agreement. They have to present the Rays with a stadium capable of hosting Major League Baseball on an annual basis. So because last year they didn't, the lease extends by a year, so that gets the Rays here through 2028. So there's three more years left on the lease. The city says it's going to be fixed in time. They have started, as you said, the first of 24 roof panels was put up the other day. But, you know, we've heard different things. The city says the inside of the building is definitely repairable. Once they get the roof on, they're going to go to work and fix everything inside. We've heard from other people who've been in the building. There's standing water. There's mold. There's issue. You know, the anchors that hold the seats look like they're rusted. So we haven't seen a list yet of what's going to be repaired and what isn't. And what is the city considered ready to play a Major League Baseball game versus what are the Rays think? MLB is involved with this, too. There's a working committee. They have somebody on that committee. So we think they're going to play. They're going to open the season. I think we talked about this the other day. It sounds like they're going to open the season in St. Louis. They're on a three-city road trip that buys 10 extra days. They're right now scheduled to open on April 6th at home. If the stadium's not ready, the commissioner says there's a contingency plan. I would assume it's coming back here to Steinbrenner Field. Mm-hmm. Maybe the Yankees will get another nice check for being the hosts, because we know
they landlords.
We know the Yankees need the money.
Yeah. Well, you're going to pay for their reliever that they'll get a couple innings out of.
Exactly.
Yeah, Rays.
Yeah. A couple months. Yeah. So uncertainty about the short-term home. We think Tropicana Field's going to be ready, if not maybe April 6th at some point during the year. Okay. And then long-term home. There was an agreement last July under the current ownership group to end this decades-long quest and build a new stadium literally next to Tropicana Field, kind of like the Cardinals have, like Ballpark Village. Mm-hmm. Texas has Texas Live. The Braves have the Battery. This was kind of be modeled like that, like entire development kind of built around the new ballpark. It would, you know, people would live there, people would work there, it'd be tons of places to eat, drink, shop, all that kind of stuff. The Rays had agreed to that, then the hurricane created some complications, and after they came out on the other side, said they cost them so much money to pause the progress that they then pulled out of the deal. There was a deadline during spring training that they had to either sign it and make it all official or pause it, and they just said, no, we're not doing it. So as we sit here, to recap, we don't know who the owners are going to be. We don't know where they're going to play short term. We don't know where they're going to play long term. Otherwise, things are going great.
I am I don't even know what to do with that, except for I love the fact that you like dropped a little tidbit of breaking news on the best podcast in baseball, that it looks like the Rays are going to be opening in St. Louis. When the schedule is coming out at some point in time. It's supposed to come out here shortly. It's already late. Part of it is the complications with the World Cup. Also, the union gets a month with it or so around that time. So they're going to go over and vet to make sure it's followed all the CBA rules. But yeah, the Cardinals are opening at home. Know that. And it sounds like the Rays will be in town. I find it interesting that a team can just live perpetually under the shadow of not sticking around. Like, it almost seems like that's just part of the Rays' identity at this point. Just like the Oakland Athletics, Kansas City Athletics, Philadelphia Athletics, Las Vegas Athletics, moving is part of their. I just find that so interesting that maybe the uncertainty is just part of having baseball here in Tampa Bay, and it goes with it. Or like hockey in Atlanta. You know, there's just uncertainty, and it'll cycle through teams. And I do find that interesting to never get stable here.
Yeah, it is interesting. By the way, did you say Sacramento A's? You're not supposed to say Sacramento A's.
I have, you know what I've called them in print? I'm very proud. I've called them the Sacramento Subleasers.
Well done.
Because I thought
well
that done. I'm not supposed to call them the A's.
Right.
So I called them the Sacramento Subleasers, and it just went through.
There you go. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if the actual players, for example, pay attention enough to like feel like there's a threat of moving, like, because it's always been the lease was through the 2027 season.
Yeah,
and up until a couple of years ago, that was a long time from now, and this is an organization that doesn't really keep players for a very long time.
Right.
So there was really, in fact, I'm trying to remember who it might have been. Wander Franco, actually, to bring up a name that you don't hear much around or hear anymore. The first time a player signed a contract that actually would have kept them in a Rays uniform past when the Tropicana Field lease expired.
Got it.
We've never really had somebody like, and Kevin Cash and Eric Neander got extensions a couple years ago. We weren't given the exact term, but we're kind of given enough background information to do the math and realize they were signed until like 29 or 30, so they would be here, or at least obligated to be here if you know, whoever the boss is wants to keep them. But it really haven't had the players in that situation. And then with the hurricane issue, you know, it almost became like you can't really kind of bitch about that because it was a natural disaster. It was an act of God.
Right,
people
right.
lost their lives. People lost their homes. People lost their jobs. You can't complain that you're a baseball player making millions of dollars and you're not sure if 2 or 3 years from now you might have to move, right? So they were handled that pretty well. But, you know, this franchise, it's never really been a direct threat. Remember a couple years ago, the Rays owners wanted to do the split season idea. They wanted to play half the year in Montreal, and everyone thought it was a joke and a negotiating ploy, and I don't know. I don't ever want to think like I'm the most gullible person in the room and talking to the Rays about it, maybe more than anyone not involved in their organization or in MLB. I mean, they convinced me. I'm not saying they convinced me it was a good idea, but they convinced me they were serious about it. This wasn't a negotiating ploy. It wasn't to get someone here to panic and sign, you know, build them a new stadium. It wasn't to extract money from people. They thorough research on this project and made a case why that was going to work. So I think that's the first time people here thought it was possible, but they were angry. They were like angry that the owner would take half the team out. I think that's where the tide started to turn a little bit against Stu Sternberg's ownership group, where people started not being, they're happy what they did on the field, but I think at that point that kind of got people a little concerned what his ulterior motive was.
It's interesting you touch on that, because one of the things I wanted to ask you is about this like kind of perpetually on the precipice notion is how the fans react to it, and if any part of this is like, okay, having the Rays is great, having, you know, the Yankees visit so often is great, having the Boston visit a lot, but if you take Major League Baseball away from the summer here, fans are like, well, we'll still have Major League Baseball because of spring training. Like, if that also is a factor, like, it's not entirely a threat that Major League Baseball is going to leave this area if the Rays go somewhere else, and if that plays into it at all. Like, all right, the Rays are here and they're enjoyable and they got good support, but the constant like unknown of are they going to leave to go somewhere else, is that at all tempered by the fact that spring training's around?
I think maybe to a degree, and I also think there's just a certain degree of people who just don't care, a certain degree of apathy. Mm. And the other problem we have here is we have so many problems here, Derek. People think it's a great place to live, but we have so many problems. Another one is the Tampa people view having to come to St. Pete as like climbing Mount Everest and then going through the Sahara Desert and then swimming to Hawaii. Okay. It's like to get from Tampa to St. Pete for a baseball game is the most incredible ask ever. But the people in St. Pete have no problem going to Tampa to go to the airport, to go to the best shopping mall in town, to go to the hockey arena that is also the number like one or two concert venue in the United States of America.
Oh, right, right,
to go
right.
to Raymond James Stadium for Bucks games, USF football, occasional huge concerts there. USF's campus is in Tampa. So this thing is in people's head in Tampa that they can't come to St. Pete. And that's their team, not our team.
Mm.
So playing here this year has kind of poked some holes in that because they haven't even sold out every game at 10,000 capacity. But my point being, so there's just a certain amount of apathy in this market of if the Rays leave, oh, well, they weren't our team for the Tampa people.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do think it would be missed. And certainly, you know, knowing the owner of like the biggest sports bar near Tropicana Field, he's had to cut his staff. His business has been down 30%. He's become a concert venue almost seven nights a week, just trying to find ways to get people to come because they're not coming for Rays games. So you see it affect real people, too, and you kind of get that sense. So I do think that it would be missed. I don't think it would be missed by the whole community. But I think when they came to that agreement on the new stadium, even the people who hated the idea of another stadium being built in downtown St. Pete, we're happy that, okay, we've got to the point of resolution. We don't have to hear about this more. We've had stadium fatigue for, you know, 10, 12 years now. Mm-hmm. They're staying. Good for them. Let those people in St. Pete enjoy it, whatever. I mean, you've been here many times. I mean, it's that bridge isn't that – it's not that long. And
no.
There's traffic. But you know what? There's traffic in New York and St. Louis and Chicago and Boston. And there's people that commute for an hour and a half to go to baseball games doing two or three modes of transportation in some of those big cities. They drive to the train station by their house. They take the train in. They get off. They take a subway to the game. Like, people do that. We know people who do that. But here, it's a little different animal. So I think it would be missed. I don't think it would be missed by everyone. But I also think that, you know, there have been enough kind of these false hopes now of let's get this resolved that people are now willing to see what the new ownership group does. There's kind of like a little bit of a new window here to get a stadium situation worked out.
That drive from the Tampa airport, my grandpa would pick me up at the Tampa airport as I flew in either from Chicago or Denver. He'd pick me up, and that bridge would be where I got caught up on all the doings on our drive to Sarasota. I would hear all the things that awaited me, that grandma had planned for us to do, the chores that I needed to do, and then, you know, I'd hear about the baseball and all that stuff as well, as my grandpa would have a captive audience for that drive from Tampa to Sarasota. You brought up I do find one thing about Tampa really fascinating here is this, you drive on the interstate and there's the green highway signs, right, that say what's nearby, the universities, historic things and everything like that, and exits. And there's one that has the only sports team's name on it is the New York Yankees. That's amazing to me. It says Raymond James Stadium. So it doesn't even say Tampa Bay Buccaneers. It says Raymond James Stadium, New York Yankees. They do claim, I mean, Tampa does kind of claim the Yankees as like significant part of the area, right? Enough to go on a green sign like an art museum, right?
Well, I also think that the Steinbrenner family is very influential in
all right.
Tampa area.
That's true.
So it could also be that perhaps that was a request.
Okay, yeah, that works.
Because I think there's a sign maybe going in a different direction they're speaking of where it says Yankee Spring Training Steinbrenner Field. So they get the name and the team.
Yeah, that is. But, I saw that too, yeah.
So I do think that's part of it. And yeah, having now covered the bulk of a season here, we're not quite done yet, but the bulk of a season here, there's a few other things that made me think the Steinbrenner family is very in with some of the Hillsborough County people as far as some of the other rules and regulations that need to be followed. But yeah, look, it's a big deal. I mean, there are a lot of people in Tampa, and again, I'm not picking on them, but I'm saying this is true. I mean, there are people in Tampa who identify as Yankee fans more than they do as Rays fans, even though, you know, yes, they have spring training here, yes, they have a minor league team here, yes, they have their minor league base here, but realistically, you're talking about 14 or 15 Major League spring training games. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Class A team is a team that averages 600, 700 fans a game. It's a low A team that got displaced this year because the Rays are using their stadium. But essentially, the identity of the Yankees is those spring training games. People do. But there is a lot of people here. We've heard from people at Tropicana Field. Some of the ushers have told us stories that when the Yankees come in to play the Rays at Tropicana Field, under the old schedule when it was three visits rather than two, that they said there are people who had season tickets in their section that for the other, you know, 70-whatever games were wearing Rays gear. But those same people, when the Yankees were there, were wearing their Yankees gear. Yeah, so even the baseball, true baseball lovers had their true colors.
That is I think it's so interesting. But also, like, it does talk about that the area is fertile for baseball. Like, that there is a strength here. You mentioned apathy about the Rays, but there is a fan base for the game here, and how it manifests is different, or how it gets a place it can just call home without the question is a big part of it.
That. The Cardinals and Mets. I mean, you go back to the Yankees had spring training in St. Petersburg before they went to Fort Lauderdale and then ended up here in Tampa. The Cardinals are a deep, deep part, a rich part of the baseball tradition here in St. Petersburg. The Mets were here for a long time, and there were a few others that popped in. The Orioles had a couple of years. The San Francisco, or maybe they were in the New York Giants, then had a year here. But essentially, this area, you know, when I first came here in 1983, it was spring training haven. It was the Mets and Cardinals shared Allang Stadium. They both had their own facilities, as you know, but for your listeners. So there was a spring training game every single day of the spring. It was either Mets or Cardinals. Two fun, high-profile teams loaded with star players.
They did not like each other.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, and you know, then you have the Phillies have been in this area for a super long time. The Reds were here for a long time, so there's still people. In fact, where we are right now, Steinbrenner Field, is just across the street from where the Reds' spring stadium used to be.
Right. I forgot. So
there's Reds' history here, Cardinal history here, Mets' history here, Phillies' history here. The Blue Jays, since they were a team, have been here in the Pinellas County area on the other side of the bridge in Dunedin. So there is a tremendous baseball, you know, appetite and level of interest here, as you know, you said at the start of this passage, but it just hasn't caught on for a number of reasons that all those people have become Rays fans.
You mentioned that in September you have a transfer of power possibly coming up in ownership. The Cardinals have one of their own. Do you like that?
Pro segue, dude. Yeah. You could be on TV.
Okay, yeah. No, have you seen this? No, I'll save it for... There's a reason why we haven't yet figured out how to do a YouTube version of this podcast. The Cardinals have one coming up as well. Han Bloom, who was here for a long time, he came in as an intern in 05, worked his way up, got all the way to senior VP of baseball operations. That was the title. He had many years there. Sort of saw the Rays build into the perennial playoff team they were from, say, 19 through the early 2020s, though he was not with them as that run of playoffs, because he went to Boston to run the Red Sox baseball operations. Knowing that Han Bloom never had the lead job for the Rays front office, can you describe, though, how his influence was clear, just his presence here and sort of what his role was here?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the most simple answer to your question is Haim was a guy that no matter what task he was given to do, he did it well. And then essentially was rewarded and moved up. And it just got to the point where, I mean, it's like, okay, the Rays messed up. They had two really good guys that could each run their baseball operations department, and you can't really split that duty. And they eventually had to decide, and they decided on Eric Neander. And at that point, led to Haim getting some opportunities. He'd interviewed elsewhere. He'd interviewed with the Mets
and the Phillies.
There may have been one other that we never quite pinned down. Haim's not the most, by the way, not that you're really going to like hearing this, he's not the most forthcoming guy.
Okay.
He's going to have some secrets. There's going to be some things he's not going to tell you. Just a heads up. Not that you've necessarily...
I don't know anything like
before.
That. No, I'm not aware.
Yeah, I can't imagine that you've been used to that situation. But just as a heads up,
there have been times where a transaction came up, and I'm like, "Hey, you made that transaction. We didn't make that transaction. It's right there. It's on the. I have the.
Everyone else knows about it. Right?
Like I see it on the. Right. It's like it's on the guy's baseball reference page or minor league baseball. It's there. Like it's in your game. Oh, we haven't made that yet. All right.
Yeah. Okay. Whatever. So. Thus, outside of Haim not telling you everything, but I think every level, everything he was given to do with the Rays, and I know he did start as an intern. I think he picked people up at the airport and stuff like that, true intern duties. But everything he was given to do, he did well. He's thorough. He is earnest. He will and you know contemplate the impact of the decisions and things like that. And those are all good things. You don't want someone just randomly, oh yeah, let's do this, and then let's do that, and then let's go this way. And you know, precedent, impact, all those are things that, you know, he's going to, you know, you'll probably hear those words, but he'll discuss. But I think it just got to the point where there wasn't room for two really good guys. And like I said, they chose Eric Neander. I don't know that that was, you know, right or wrong, to be honest with you. They certainly could have chosen Haim. You look at some of the impact of the move Haim made with the Red Sox. I know it didn't end well, but their farm system didn't get good on its own. Their farm system got good because Haim Bloom made that a priority when he was charged with running that team. He had to trade some guys that you look back and say, why in the world would you ever trade Mookie Betts? Well, I don't think Haim woke up one day and said, you know what, I'm going to trade Mookie Betts today. That seems like something he was told he had to do and tried to make the best deal he could. So it'll be curious to see. I mean, it's such an unusual arrangement you have in St. Louis where he's been given this platform, right, to essentially watch and observe and consult. And I'm sure he's probably had his hand on some of the things, but just to really get your chance. Usually you get hired in these jobs and you're hired in the off season and you're like, we got to make a decision on arbitration, guys, in a week. What are we going to do? And you're calling in assistants whom you may not even know their full name and certainly don't have that bond and trust and saying, what are we going to do? Or somebody calls with a trade offer. I mean, he's had an opportunity to have this great runway here, so you would assume he hits the ground when this transfer of power happens, and first thing he does is call you and say, what do you think we should do? And you go from there.
Yeah, no, I'm sure that'll... I mean, it is interesting because, you know, I've likened it to the fact that, you know, he's inheriting, a sports car, right? And it's one that... It needs to be more fuel efficient. It needs to be modernized. It needs to do all the things because it's aging and it's idling, you know, quite literally. It's just kind of stuck and it needs up. But really, the better analogy might be that he gets to build the car he's going to drive. And he's spent so much of his first year with the team, he spent it just auditing the whole thing, going through, talking to people, meeting people, scribbling down notes and reports and things that they could do. And they're like, okay, we like that, now do it. And then he spent this year doing that, like upgrading and expanding and modernizing the player development in a way that so few new executives, they kind of have to ride the horse they're given when they're hired to be the president of baseball operations. He got to design it, and he has this whole year to know, all right, this is the bedrock of what I'm going to then inherit and run. It's really fascinating. How big was his profile here, even though he was sort of a lieutenant, for lack of a better description? How big was his profile around the team?
Yeah, I mean, and just one thing from what you just said, too, before we answer your question, is that he's had all this opportunity, as you said, to build things how he wants. But also, he's also done the job before, too, in a market, you know, as big or bigger than St. Louis, too. This isn't a guy who's coming from the Tampa Bay Rays to take over the St. Louis Cardinals. Now, when he went from the Tampa Bay Rays to take over the Boston Red Sox, there were people questioning that.
Quantum leap.
Yeah, but, you know, St. Louis is an incredible baseball market, fertile market tradition. Boston, you know, for a small group that you'd say are kind of in that same level, right? And so he should be well prepared. And his profile here, there were times where he was the lead guy. I mean, I certainly interviewed him many times. There were times when, you know, he would answer for things that didn't go right. But there also was the fact that, you know, he wasn't ultimately in charge. There were other people. At one point, they did a couple of stair-step promotion things here. And at one point, he and Eric Neander were kind of at the same level, but then Matt Silverman, who'd been the business side team president, was brought over to be the team, essentially like the president of baseball operations. They didn't call him that. But Haim also had the ability to think about this. He worked with Andrew Friedman, who's really good at running the Dodgers.
Well, that's who does. Okay, got it. Now, no, I'm kidding.
Matt Arnold, who does a pretty good job running the Brewers.
Really, yeah.
Here.
Yeah.
Obviously, Art Neander, we've mentioned him. There's a couple others I'm trying to think of slipped my mind as far as other GMs. He ran the Blue Jays. He ran the Astros for a while.
Glick.
James Click is another one who worked here. See how quickly you forget. So there have been
four. He's not with the Blue Jays. Yeah.
That's what I was thinking. Okay. Yeah. So there have been four or five guys.
He had that weird thing where they won the World Series. He didn't get the extension. Didn't really want it, apparently. Had to represent the Astros at the GM meetings, knowing that they were likely to hire a new GM. And then he ended up with Toronto. And, you know, he's really strong. He has really strong connections with Chaim Bloom. If Cardinal fans are trying to put together a list of executives who might show up as the GM of the Cardinals, I'm not sure how appealing that job is for him, having been, you know, his role with the Jays and what he did with Astros. It's not exactly a promotion from that, certainly. But if you're starting to put together a short list of where the Cardinals might look at executives, he's on there.
That's a good one too, and he's a pretty sharp guy as well. But
yes,
I think one of the things Chaim was kind of in charge of here, which would correspond with having had this so much time that you just mentioned with the Cardinals, was the farm system. And I think that was one of the things, right, he's been able to kind of work on, the player development staff.
Been the focus.
Yeah. So that was one thing here. And certainly being in this organization, because of their limited revenue and because of how they operate their major league payroll, and not to suggest he's going to bring the Cardinals' finances down, but he's learned the Rays way of investing, and the way, you know, you invest is in the farm system. Talent is cheapest when you get it at the amateur level, whether it's through the amateur draft, through its international free agent signings, and it's through trades of getting players at the minor league level. I mean, Junior Caminero, who is the Rays' best player now by far, played one Dominican Summer League season when the Rays got him from the Cleveland organization. Curtis Meade, who it didn't work out as well, but he was acquired coming out of like one complex league season in the Phillies organization. They traded for Christopher Sanchez, who has now gotten, like, been on an all-star team and gotten Cy Young votes. So they don't always work out, but I think, you know,
really good pitcher.
Developing on your own, not being afraid to trade for super young guys, getting as much amateur talent, low-level talent when it's cheap, is the way to kind of build your system up without spending a ton of money, and then use the money when you want to make free agent signings and have big impacts. Those are things that I think Chaim did here and learned here.
The story will have already been on our site by the time the podcast reaches it, but the thing you brought up about the jumping from here to Boston and just the different expectations, that's actually one thing that I talked to Neander about. I talked with Eric Neander about Chaim Bloom, and it's a small subplot that I'm very interested in seeing, of how the skill set required in Boston, however that ended, what he learned there, and what he then had, I mean, then was let go, either because of the pressure or because of the public perception or whatever the reason, what he gained there, to take that and mix it with nimble and innovative that you had to be here. I think that's a really interesting or intriguing fit with St. Louis. History of Boston, not exactly the same sort of financial situation, but definitely better than the financial situation here. And so maybe it's the best place to blend those two. And as I was asking, this is the lead to the story that I'm trying to write, is as I was kind of presenting that to Neander, he cut me off and he's like, yeah, they both kind of funnel right to what St. Louis is. Mm-hmm. Like, if you were to pick those two things, the hybrid of it is St. Louis.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, and Eric's a very smart man, and I think that's what you and I were kind of headed toward that too, is that, yeah, Chaim is prepared to do this job with the Cardinals. He's had the big market, big exposure, big payroll opportunities. He's had
big pressure.
Big pressure. He's had the small market, not as much pressure, not expectations. Little engine that could mindset that the Rays have here. You do blend that together. And the only difference is going to be he's going to have to deal with a really aggressive beat writer in St. Louis. So that might be, you know, the big flaw there for him, is you have to deal with you on a daily basis.
I've been encouraged to ask him questions about 1800s baseball. And so, you know, real litmus test right off the hop will be, who was the first pitcher in Cardinals history. We'll have a really good debate about that. Who was it? Was it 1882? Was it 1892? Was it 1899? You're gonna have to choose a side here.
Okay.
Well, also, by the way, if you go to lunch with him, he's a really fast eater. So don't be prepared to like try to do the talk and eat thing. Just eat and then talk. That's my advice.
Wait, how does that work?
Well, I'm saying instead of trying to weave the questions in while you're eating, just like you eat and he eats, and then you just sit and talk for a little while after. Just a little friendly tip here.
I don't know how to do what like you just. I don't know what to do there. Like, this is really fascinating. Like, wait, you just take your time. Go to your separate corners and eat.
No, like if you say, hey, can we grab some lunch and then we're going to do an interview? So eat lunch and then do the interview, because otherwise he's going to eat too fast and you're not going to be ready for the questions.
I have to eat fast too.
Or get a smaller portion.
All right, I see what you're saying. All right, point taken. That's so interesting.
I'm tripping you up. Sorry.
No, I'm trying to think about it because it's like the only. Just back to my grandfather. The only person I know who like would just devour, inhale food without talking was my grandfather. But every other setting I've been in, food is part of the conversation. If that makes sense, it's not.
Maybe he'll be a changed guy with baked ravioli and stuff, but I'm just saying.
Toasted ravioli.
Let's be straight.
Come on.
All the St. Louis people are going to think I'm what an idiot. Sorry. Yeah. Toasted ravioli. But, just saying, one of the things Haim is known for is to being a very fast eater, so you don't want to be where you're still in mid-chew when it's your turn to ask him a question.
Okay. All right. This is very helpful.
This is inside information here, buddy.
Yeah. This is very helpful. No. Okay. I'm gonna have to really change my approach, but also, chances of us being. I mean, let's be honest. That doesn't happen.
I only had, I think, one or two lunches with him as well. It happens. But just in case, I want you to be prepared.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. I would like to know what your thought is about how he might present the video. You certainly talked to him at a high level about what direction to take a baseball team, baseball operations. I mean, what do you expect him, or how is his presentation going when he's talking about the vision of a team and what he looks for, what he puts the stress on? You mentioned player development. It sure sounds like that's where it begins. And is he then able to kind of articulate that vision?
I would think so, and I think being in Boston, certainly more so than here, he understands words are important and words matter, and he's not going to come out and make what would be kind of viewed by fans as a mistake and saying like, we're going to be on a 7-year plan here or something like that. I'm sure he's going to tell you at his opening media session that the goal is to win as quickly as possible, but also build something that's sustainable for the future. That's kind of a motto from here. And I would think that's going to be a guiding principle with him, is the Rays go into every year hoping that they have, or not, I shouldn't even say hoping, because one of Stu Sternberg, the owner's things is he's one of those hope's not a good strategy people. Okay. And he's also never go all in strategy person. So
that's convenient.
But I do think that Haim will have come out of this environment and he'll know enough to say that, their goal here is to be in the mix every year. They know it's not going to happen every year, but they don't like to do the arc thing where you build and then you tear it down and you build
a 6-year cycle.
What the Astros Cubs did. I mean, it worked really well for the Astros, right? I mean, think of how many times they've been in the playoffs since they went through that. But the Rays have always been kind of like they just want to be in the fight every year. And like I haven't talked to Haim, obviously, about this new challenge that he's facing, but I would assume that, that would stick with him because that was certainly a big part of the process here. And, most of his learning of his, you form your philosophies based on your life experience, and most of that was here.
Here, one of the things about the Tampa Bay Rays, and you mentioned it with the contracts, there are very few contracts that take a guy deep into his career. There are very few, and I wonder if there ever will be a career-long Ray. It's just not really set up that way here. That is something that matters to the Cardinals. The ownership has talked about legacy Cardinals and keeping players for the entirety of their career. Maybe that shifts a little bit. Maybe that's going to have to shift for the Cardinals just because of the nature of the economics, but it is something that at least the fan base has traditionally hung on to. Always had a Hall of Famer going back 100 plus years in uniform. Tampa native Tony La Russa is part of that run. So we'll see. But, you know, the Rays have stars when they're young, and then they are almost braced for them to go elsewhere as free agents. This is a long way of getting to the last thing that I wanted to ask you, and that is, and to pull that off, you have to be a development machine. They have Junior here now who has tremendous power, and like really standout power, which is the game these days when it talks to any. What do the Rays do to develop hitters that you've seen? Because that is where the Cardinals have really hit a stumbling block. They have not really had that impact middle order hitter from out of their own system. I mean, really since Matt Carpenter. J.J. Weatherholt's really good, and he's rising 2-for-2 off of Chris Sale the other night. So he's on his way. But to say Matt Carpenter is like the last all-star impact hitter that a team produced, and before that it was Albert Pujols, I mean, Alan Craig. I mean, I don't know. It depends on how much longevity you need to make that. But that's really, you know, striking that they can't do it. So what do the Rays do to get that, to find that?
I probably would disagree with you only in the sense that they haven't done it very well either.
Okay.
I mean, Caminero, you know, was acquired, like I said, at a very young level from the Cleveland organization. But I think he was just a great talent. They just had to figure out how to, like, you know, keep him healthy. He missed some time with some muscle injuries and things like that, soft tissue type of stuff. But, you know, when you said Matt Carpenter, I started thinking back, well, Evan Longoria was, you know, kind of the guy for the Rays who was a power hitter here. I mean, they had B.J. Upton for a while. He hit some homers. Kyle Crawford, not as much with the power. They've had guys when they were kind of in their early years, they stressed athleticism more so. Mm-hmm. But I think they're still searching for that too. And I don't know that during Heim's tenure here that they figured that out either.
I think they had Randy. I mean, they got Randy here. They gave him playing time, and he did emerge. Now, he gets a lot of credit for that because he added strength. Randy Arozarena came via trade. I mean, he was an impact hitter here.
Right. But I don't know how much they developed him once he
That's
got
great.
Here. I think he came over and... You know, that trade was made right. It was the pandemic year. It was before spring training. So I will say this: it's the story that's probably somewhat apocryphal. Was Randy in spring training was kind of this thin, wiry guy that you're like, oh, man, he's probably strong, but he kind of struck you as thin, fast, wiry. And then he ends up living by himself during the pandemic, and supposedly, like, his agent arranged for somebody to drop off like beans, rice, and chicken at his doorstep every couple days. And he had COVID for a while when they ended up resuming camp, but he was doing, you know, it depends when you ask him, was 100 or 200 or 300 push-ups a day, and cooked his own beans and rice and chicken. And when he came out of COVID,
he was strong.
He was a strong guy here, and we've seen what he's become, obviously. So. Side point too, I don't know that they've really had a great run of developing hitters as much as when they've got them to the big leagues, figured out how to best to use them.
Okay, that's part of it.
Yeah, I think so, but I don't know that they ever unlocked that. They've been really good on developing pitching, and I think that's just because of their philosophies of treating those guys right, taking care of their arms from the start, teaching them early in their careers how you become a big league pitcher, and not worrying about the results in the minor league level as much as, you know, the process and the intent of the pitches. You hear that word a lot from guys that are coming through the system and the race to two strikes and things like that. So I think organizationally they were ahead pitching wise. I don't know if they figured out the offensive side, but I think, you know, I come back to Heim comes into this job with the Cardinals. I mean, you know, you hear this term more politically, but I'd love to see what his day one agenda is going to be because he should be prepared for this job. The time he had here and the opportunity to work under so many people. Jerry Hunsinger was here for a while.
That's right. Yeah. Houston, a long time. Houston Astros, exactly.
Yeah, in the early years when, you know, they first took over in the transition was after the 05 season and the Rays had two more bad years. Joe Maddon was here. I mean, Joe Maddon talks about when he, you know, you can talk to him now. He'll tell you about talking to Heim and talking to Eric when they were young kids and how much he learned from talking to them and their perspective on things. And so it's just, you know, he's been in a really progressive organization. He's been around some great people, some old-timers and some young people, an organization that learned how to win in a very unusual situation with, you know, a small budget and no-name players, per se.
And historic rivals lurking in the division.
Right. Competing in a division with teams whose payrolls were literally 2 and 3 times the size of theirs. They were able to win in that situation. He was a part of that. Then he goes from David to Goliath, right? And he goes to the Red Sox.
He slingshot it up there.
There you go. Very good. That's why you're Derek Gould, the greatest ever. And you know, then he deals with ownership interfering, right? That's a weird thing to have to deal with. And he deals with the public pressure and the media pressure, and you know, it doesn't work out necessarily because he gets let go. But like I said, you look at the farm system and what they've produced now, that trio of great prospects. I know one's hurt now, one's in the big leagues, and one's, I think, been up and down.
One just started Yankee Stadium. Roman, they're like, Anthony, yeah, right? Roman Anthony.
He's like the greatest player in the history of Boston baseball for this week. And then, you know, I think that I couldn't – maybe let's close with this, I guess. I don't think I could think of somebody who could be more prepared for this job than Chaim Bloom's going to be. That's not guaranteeing his success, but I don't think you could be more prepared than to have been a key part of the Rays for that long with a lot of power, decision-making, and then to be the guy in Boston. I mean, experiences, and now you're going to St. Louis, which is one of the most, you know, iconic franchises in Major League history, and you've had a chance in about a year, 2 years, to learn the landscape, to learn the pitfalls, to learn what needs to be done, to learn the people, to learn how to get things done. I would assume, you know, he's learned how ownership operates.
Yeah, he's worked with them.
He knows what the appetite of the fan base is. He probably already has put people in underneath him that, you know, are his people.
Yes, he's made two significant hires and set up a new kind of system in there for overseeing player development.
I think if they don't win 120 games in the World Series in year one, you got to rip them.
Okay. Right. That is the comment that only a seasoned baseball writer like yourself could say. You know, I'm in Tampa and St. Pete. The baseball fans in Tampa and the baseball fans in St. Pete are lucky to have you covered every minute of this team. It's really remarkable, like, just to have a baseball writer who cares as much about the coverage and is as thorough and really creative as you can be. And to have been here from the beginning really gives just these fans and these readers here so much institutional, like, knowledge. It's great. I love the fact that you're still here. I love the fact that you still ask about the future of the Rays. And I know for a fact that you're going to be there to cover the future of the Rays. I hope it's here in Tampa. Though, you know, a side trip to Montreal wouldn't be bad, right?
In the summer, for sure.
Okay, yeah. Also, could we get a roof? This rain delay is still going on. Yeah. So, Mark, thank you very much. That is Mark Tompkin, baseball writer at the Tampa Bay Times. You can read all of his coverage there. Your handle on Twitter is?
TBTimes_Rays.
TBTimes_Rays. See, just like, even like you didn't put your name. You weren't about the brand. You were about the beat.
It's all about the brand.
Man, it's just really impressive. You weren't about, like, being topper. You were about, this is my beat. I love it. You can find all of his work there. The best podcast in baseball is available wherever you get your podcast. It's brought to you weekly by Closet by Design of St. Louis. The constant Cardinals coverage is available in the pages of the Post Dispatcher, stltoday.com. For baseball writer Mark Tompkin, I'm St. Louis Post Dispatch base writer Derek Gould. Talk to you soon. Thank you very much, sir.
Anytime, buddy. Always enjoy seeing you.